Reynolds Price writes in Ardent Spirits, Leaving Home, Coming Back, that the purpose of this, his third memoir, is to convey a succession of moments which combined through 6 years in producing intense stretches of the rarest human privilege, prolonged joy. During those years, 1955 to 1961, Mr. Price was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford and then a financially strapped teacher at Duke University, his undergraduate alma mater. It was also a time of Mr. Price's slow sexual awakening as he began to form romantic relationships with some of the men he met in England. Reynolds Price, who has been a professor at Duke for over 50 years now, has written numerous works of fiction and two memoirs, Clear Pictures and A Whole New Life. Ardent Spirits is published by Scribner. I'm very pleased it has brought him back to the show. Hi, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Very glad to be here.
In your introduction, you write that 2 years after you became a paraplegic because of spinal cancer, your mind began to yield great stretches of memory as a consequence of having all that time to yourself to meditate.
I think that certainly had a great deal to do with it. But I have found out now in my old age, I'm 76, that I do seem to have a tremendously active sort of ancient memory, far back memory. This new book, for instance, is basically memories that are 50, 51 or 2 years ago. And when I was able to check these memories against any old letters, whatever, I found out that they were accurate. So I am impressed by my long-term memory. My short-term memory, of course, like most people my age, is over with 15 minutes after I've used it.
I always wondered why that is, why people can conjure up so many distant memories and can't remember that they met you 15 minutes ago.
I've talked with psychiatrists and all sorts of other types of people about it, and no one has a satisfactory answer.
Well, the diagnosis was in 1984, wasn't it? So when did you start writing this memoir?
I started writing this memoir, well, about 5 years ago now. It took me about 4 years in the writing, yeah.
And you kept journals at the time?
I did not keep journals and never really have. Only once in my life I kept a journal for 1 year. And when I got to the 366th day, I just sort of fell over the finish line like an Olympic runner and said, never again.
But you also...
This was sort of based on memory. And ultimately,
letters.
I realized once I'd written it, that there were lots of letters that I'd written to my mother, which I found in the Duke University Library and was able to read and check against my own memories.
Because that's something I think that will be lost to a lot of people today.
Exactly.
The emails are erased eventually, but the letters that we used to write, I know I also spent a year in England, and people saved my letters. I saved their letters.
Absolutely.
And what was stunning to me was just how an idiot I was at that time. But that's a whole other matter.
I know.
You discover a different person.
To realize what a dope you were when you were young.
Have you had such an eventful life that it's required three memoirs? Space pretty far apart.
To me it has. Yeah. I'm very careful about not writing. About writing about stuff that is basically going to be interested to readers who are strangers to me.
Well, you say that Ardent Spirits is about prolonged joy. Isn't happiness the hardest emotion to sustain over the course of a book? It's a lot easier to write about depression or melancholy or murderous rage than
I think you're
happy.
Absolutely right. And I was careful to try to select episodes, characters from a rich and full life that I thought would be interesting and that would reflect happiness, but also be very honest about unhappiness and matters that really did cost me a lot.
Well, most people have to find a job after they graduate from college. Do you think your postgraduate years were happier because you were spared that immediate dose of reality and also allowed you to escape a rather troubled family life?
It was very helpful. Though when I got to Oxford, my father had only died 18 months before I got there. And he had asked me to sort of supervise his death from lung cancer at the age of 54.
Had you gotten along well with him?
I had got on very well with him. Though we had not, we didn't have the sort of roll on the floor father-son relationship that now seems to be much featured on television. But I think it was clear that we loved one another. And when he realized he was dying and was going to be in a hospital for 3 or 4 weeks before his death, he just asked me if I'd come and stay with him, and I did.
Did he suspect that you might become a homosexual, or did he sense any of that in you?
I don't think he had the faintest suspicion, though what I talk about at some length in the book early on is my discovery many years later that his own very best friend, who was best man at his wedding, had given, though married with a child, had given a number of symptoms that he himself was homosexual. So the question is, you know, did my father spend a great deal of his time with a homosexual friend and not know about it and in any sense not participate in it? I just don't know.
No, I almost said the word gay. I know you don't like that word. You prefer queer, actually.
Was queer the
word that was in currency in 1955?
Yeah, that was
among,
the word in
among
currency. And I've asked a couple of friends since I've been up here in the city what would have been the phrase and the word in their time, and they've all said queer. I think gay was a mistake for a number of reasons, but it's too late. It's now the word, and I say it myself, though I, in the book, tend to use queer.
Years ago, the executive editor of the New York Times asked a number of gay petitioners, why should we use gay instead of homosexual? And he said, because it will make your headline writers a lot happier. Now, you were leaving for England on a Rhodes Scholar at a time when your father had died, and there was some economic hardship. Did you feel like you were abandoning them?
There was very little money in the family. My mother had to go to work like a few days after my father's funeral. She got a job as a stand-up salesman in a boys' clothing store in Raleigh, North Carolina, and did that really for the rest of her life up until a couple of years before she died when her own vision failed. But, my brother got to work with a small job that helped him on through high school. And ultimately, I was gone for 3 years, and ultimately, and I was living off the perhaps ill-gotten gains of Cecil Rhodes, who, as I always say, invented diamonds, mm-hmm. which he, in a sense, did. And finally, at the end of 3 years, with a good deal of guilt still on my back, I came home, and I had a job teaching freshman English at Duke University, and I went to work and did that, and I'm still doing it 51 years later.
You went to England in a transatlantic trip. It's not a cruise. I forgot what it's called. I know I did it 5 years later. I went on the New Amsterdam when I went to school in England. Very few people flew there at that time unless they were very wealthy.
It was so expensive. You're right.
But you had this five-day trip, and you ate the best food.
You got to take long naps, and you had the further advantage that every night you set the clock back an hour when you went to bed, and so you had no jet lag when you got to England.
My guest is Reynolds Price, whose latest book is the third installment of his memoirs called Ardent Spirits, Leaving Home, Coming Back. It's published by Scribner. Is this the last? You still probably have all sorts of stories to tell.
Well, I do, and the question is, do I have the time to tell them? I have no, I see no available wood to knock on, but there are stretches of my life which I think are interesting that I'd like to write about. There's also more than one piece of fiction that I'd like to write, so let's see.
You write that the transatlantic trip allowed you to think about different moments in your life, and at one point you say, my memories of the start of an erotic life center on a room of my own when I was 11. So you were on the ship, and you're thinking about your sexuality?
Yeah, I was just sort of thinking about a great deal that had happened in my prior life since I was now separated from it, because men of my time, Americans of my time, had never been anywhere. You know, I was born in 1933, the worst single year of the Depression, on all the charts, the family had no money. Nobody had any money.
But you'd never been abroad before.
Never been abroad before. And furthermore, we traveled very little in the United States because gasoline was very expensive and rationed. So we had basically sat in small towns in North Carolina and gone to school there. And I came to New York for the first time when I was 17 years old and went to see the marvelous plays that were here then. I saw Julie Harris and Ethel Waters in Member of the Wedding, and to my joy, I encountered Miss Harris in my hotel yesterday, and We had been friends earlier and hadn't seen her since she'd had her stroke, and it's wonderful to see her and to realize that her speech is much less affected than I had thought it might be.
Did you go through the typical, I'm going to use the word queer thing because that's the word you prefer in the book, trying to be interested in girls? When you were in school?
Well, I was interested in some girls to a certain point for a certain time. I don't remember sort of trying to force myself to do this. It seemed sort of natural to do. In fact, on my way up here, I stopped off in Washington for a couple of days, D.C., and spent several days with seeing a young woman who had been very dear to me in those days. But life and time just sort of took over. Of course, in those days, every magazine you picked up, every movie you saw, every radio program you listened to did not talk about queer or gay or anything else. And so I was not confronted by the reality and the necessity of any kind of choice.
But there was literature. There was Proust, and there was André Gide, yeah, definitely. And you read Gide's Corydon.
I read Corydon, which was the first serious queer book I ever read, and I ordered it from Brentano's by mail and stashed it away in the back of my bookshelf in case I don't think my parents would have known what it was about if they looked at it, but still, I read a great deal of queer material, yeah.
In hopes of discovering more about yourself?
Maybe, though again, I think
because don't we read novels to some degree to also understand ourselves if the novel is good and gives us certain insights?
I don't think there were a number of famous queer novels in those days, certainly not in American fiction that I can remember. And I did read Gide. I read Proust. I read...
So all the homosexuals in literature were French.
Revisited,
or English.
The kinds of the books that a boy of that time might have read. But it was certainly not my exclusive reading. I read a great deal else.
You say you suffered almost no pain on the subject of being queer, but that's almost. You were growing up in the South. I don't know whether it was as religiously conservative then as it is now, but I would assume that you would have heard also, even in New York City, you would have heard all sorts of awful things.
Exactly. And, of course, people who discuss it now tend to forget that until very recently in the United States, it was illegal in most states of the Union, such activities. The Supreme Court only changed that matter quite recently. And so, people didn't just leap out and suddenly say, I'm queer, I'm gay, whatever you're going to call it.
Didn't you once receive a cautionary tale about homosexuality from John Gielgud?
I did, and it's a lengthy,
very
interesting piece in the book. I went with a friend who was a friend of Gielgud's to his house in London, a lovely small house there behind Westminster Abbey, for lunch with two or three other guys whom I assume were queer. And after lunch, we went upstairs to have coffee in this beautiful house of his. And just with no prompting whatsoever, as I recall, he began to describe this awful situation in his own life that had occurred, I've forgotten how many years, maybe 6 or 7 years earlier, when the Queen had finally knighted him after years, apparently, of the governments being very nervous about knighting him for fear he might cause them embarrassment. And sure enough, he got arrested in a men's room coming home from a party late at night and was taken immediately to a magistrate's court and fined, and maybe thought he didn't think to give a false name for himself, which, by the way, Alec Guinness turns out to have done a few years earlier and spared himself later trouble. But Gielgud, in short, the newspapers the next morning suddenly came out, Sir John Gielgud arrested him.
But it did, going there, it did give you an opportunity to meet some pretty famous and important people, even a few Americans like Lionel Trilling. And I wonder about that because that was my experience in England. Being an American actually gave me more entree than I would have had here.
Wonderful. There were so few Americans there.
Did you run into any anti-American sentiment? Because you were at Oxford, which was not as much a hotbed of of leftist activity as Cambridge was.
No, it wasn't. And I encountered extremely little, thank God, extremely little anti-American emotion. One or two men in my college, which was a quite small college, Merton College, the oldest college at Oxford, and I think there were maybe 250. There were only men there. There were no women in most of the men's colleges at Oxford then. And I think I remember being sort of challenged in a rather nasty way by one man at a little coffee after lunch one day. But it was just a very rare occurrence. Most people wanted to come to America and see the place because very few Englishmen had been here.
Well, you arrived at a time when Britain was still recovering from World War II.
Absolutely.
It must have been a major culture shock, especially being in Oxford, which is a small college town.
Well, I had forgot, if I ever knew, until quite recently when I was writing the book, that food rationing in England only ended the year before I got there. Now, cooking and eating in England at that time was pretty grim, as is famous. But I didn't know until quite recently that the food supply was severely limited up until about the time that I did get there.
Did you ever regret that you did this, as wonderful as this experience was, instead of just going off and devoting your time to learning how to write fiction?
I didn't regret it. Primarily because I ran into such wonderful teachers, such very exciting, amusing, challenging friends. I did, as I say, go through frequent patches of, oddly, homesickness and feeling guilty about having gone off and left my brother with little money at their disposal. But, ultimately I realized in letters from home that they weren't starving and they had numerous relatives who were helping take care of them. And that I was only going to be gone, I initially thought, 2 years and wound up staying three. But I'm very glad I went and stayed.
Yeah. And you were hanging out with the likes of Stephen Spender and Cyril Connolly.
W.H. Auden.
Not bad.
Yeah.
This after Spender had declared that he was no longer homosexual?
I don't think he ever actually stood up and declared it. He was off and on about it. And as he was in his own life, he was such a marvelous friend, and I sort of made it clear to him quite early in our friendship that sexuality was just not going to be a part of it. And so then from then on, it really was not a part of anything that concerned us, and he remained one of my two or three dearest friends until he died in 1995, four or five.
You tell a story of a doctor saying to you, "Mr. Price, if you have cancer, I'm about to have a litter of puppies." Boy, that was poor prescience on his part.
That was a time at Oxford when, it was, my God, what, 50 years before I really did have cancer. But I discovered a little small tumor in my side, which turned out to be a tiny little fatty tumor, about the size of a marble. But
your father had died of cancer, so
there
was good reason to worry.
My father had just died under a year earlier, and I became convinced that I was also dying of cancer. And the college doctor couldn't convince me otherwise, though finally this doctor that I was sent to did say, "Mr. Price, if you have a cancer, I'm going to have a litter of puppies." And I burst out laughing, and that was the end of my fear, for 50 years anyway.
Came back here, began teaching at Duke. Are a well-known writer, have had great success, and yet the teaching was a necessity? Or was it part of the joy?
Well, making money was a necessity, and I had no other job offers at the time and hadn't had a chance to sort of apply for jobs because in those days you couldn't phone back and forth across the Atlantic the way we do now or, as you say, fly back and forth. And so Duke happened to offer me a 3-year contract to come and teach freshman English, and they insisted. They said, "This is only a 3-year contract. Don't get any ideas of its lasting longer." Well, at the end of 3 years, I had published my first novel called A Long and Happy Life.
Which won the William Faulkner Award.
Won the William Faulkner Award. Made some money, not a hell of a lot, but enough to keep me going for a while and help my mother and my brother. And Duke said, "Stay on."
And other novels have included Kate Vaden, a winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction in 1986. This, the third volume of his memoirs, is called Leaving Home, Coming Back, published by Scribner. Thank you so much, Reynolds Price, for being with us again.
Thank you.